It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, across the universe. One thing we love to do on this show is talk about big ideas. And there's no bigger idea, literally, than the universe. Today, we travel across time and space, wonder what it would be like to walk on Mars, and reflect on an unforgettable childhood visit to a planetarium.
I was born in the Bronx, New York, where I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. It was about 11 stars at night. And here were thousands. And in fact, I thought it was a hoax at first. I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky. And I was struck, star-struck, really, by it.
But first, there is actually one thing that could be bigger than the universe, and that's the multiverse. Theoretical physicist Max Tegmark is one of the leading proponents of the idea that we could be living in just one of many universes. Steve Paulson caught up with him recently to talk about his new book, Our Mathematical Universe.
Max, you have a rather audacious theory that reality is ultimately a mathematical structure, not just that math describes our universe, but that our universe is made out of math, that it's a giant mathematical object. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, this sounds kind of crazy. We look around ourselves in the world and it doesn't look particularly mathematical at all. But yet, we physicists have, of course, discovered that everything in our universe is made of these elementary particles, like quarks and electrons. And if you ask, what properties does an electron actually have? You know, my friend Anthony's little son was shocked when his dad told him that electrons don't actually have a color. He was like, what? How can an object not have a color? But now, as far as we can tell, electrons have the only properties they actually have are minus one, one half, one, and so on. And although we've made up these nerdy names for these properties like electric charge and spin and Lipton number, they're just mathematical properties. They're numbers. And if you look at space itself, where we find all these particles, what properties does space have? It has the property three, the largest number of pencils you can hold perpendicularly to one another, right?
Wait, again, space has the property of three. It sounds like we're getting into Douglas Adams territory in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Of course, you know, what is the secret to life in the universe? The number 42.
Oh, yeah. I am such a big Douglas Adams fan that you probably found my book to be peppered with Douglas Adams references. And as far as we can tell, you know, neither space itself nor the particles actually have any properties at all except for mathematical properties. And for example, by just studying mathematics, the planet Neptune was discovered. The radio wave was discovered. And most recently, Peter Higgs sat down with the most advanced mathematical description we physicists ever came up with. He did a bunch of math, and then he predicted that if we build the most advanced scientific instrument ever built in Geneva and use it to smash particles together near the speed of light in a certain way, we would there discover a new particle, the Higgs boson. You know how that went? We built it. Boom, there it was. And he won a free trip to my hometown of Stockholm. And this is just one of many, many examples where this mathematical perspective of the world turns out to not just be, you know, a nifty perspective on things, but actually just really useful.
So do you find mathematics beautiful? I mean, is this why you originally became a theoretical physicist, to try to uncover this underlying mathematical structure?
I think there are two parallel tracks that have been going on in my own personal life, actually. I always loved math as a kid, and particularly beautiful mathematical pictures. I was so excited the first time I saw pictures of fractals, for example. And in parallel with that, though, as a kid, I was always very curious about to discover things. I loved detective mysteries. And when a big light bulb went off in my head, it was really when it hit me as a teenager that physics itself is the ultimate detective story. We get to find all these mathematical clues, and then we get to be part of this amazing community of detectives who have worked for hundreds of years to piece together this incredible plot that we're uncovering of what nature is really up to.
Now, there's another thing that you talk about in your book. I mean, you also argue that reality is more than just our observable universe, going back to the Big Bang 14 billion years ago, that there are actually many universes. We live in some sort of a multiverse. What makes you think that?
But before we talk about other universes, though, let's just remind ourselves what we mean by our universe. We don't mean by that in astronomy what I thought we meant as kids, namely everything that exists, which by definition would mean there couldn't be others. What we mean by our universe in astronomy is simply the spherical region of space from which light has had time to reach us so far during the 13.8 billion years since our Big Bang. Okay, so if there are galaxies that are much farther away, even the best telescopes on the planet can never see them, because we would have to wait, you know, billions of years more for the light to reach us. And the question is there more than just this space that we have access to, our universe? And the reason people have started talking about this a lot now, not just in science fiction, but also at physics conferences, is because even though we can't go see those regions directly, we have a bunch of mathematical physics theories which you've started to take seriously for other reasons, because they made other successful predictions, which actually predict that they should exist. But it also predicts that space itself is much bigger than the part that we can see, perhaps even infinite.
No, wait, I have to jump in, because I've always heard that space is not infinite. I mean, there's sort of an outer edge of space. And I mean, that when we talk about our universe expanding, that's what that is. I mean, to that outer edge. But you're saying actually space goes on forever?
This is a very fascinating misconception that a lot of people have, that we somehow know that there's an end to space. The basic fact of the matter is we don't know. Einstein came up with more elegant ways in which space could be finite. You could go really far in one direction and just find that you're back in Wisconsin again from the other direction. But this inflation theory that we have, what it actually does is it stretches space out and produces more volume everywhere. It predicts that space is vastly bigger than the part that we can see. So there are all these other regions teeming with galaxies and planets and stars. This is the first kind that I call the level one parallel universes in the book. It's just one space. We all share the same Big Bang. It's just that stuff, history played out differently.
Well, and I've heard the phrase pocket universes, as if they, you know, they're sort of pockets of these different universes all within this one giant multiverse.
Ah, so now you're going to the level two multiverse.
Oh, okay.
Where you effectively have many different Big Bangs, and each one creates one of these pocket universes. And this is also something which the inflation theory predicts. And it actually isn't quite as shocking as you might think, because in physics, whenever you have a mechanism that creates something, if you have a car factory, it produces a car, you know, it's not so strange to think that it could produce many cars. In fact, they usually do. And so if you have some kind of Big Bang creation mechanism going on in physics, you could imagine it making many bangs.
Now, you have other versions of multiple universes as well, something that you call the level three multiverse. And this, I have to say, this starts to get really strange. I mean, this gets into what has been called the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. The world is constantly splitting into alternative realities. Can you explain this?
So this is a multiverse which has been brought to us from a completely different direction. When you start zooming in to the micro world instead and ask what everything is made out of, you discover these particles and you start studying them. Quantum mechanics governs this, and the supreme law of the land there is what's known as the Schrödinger equation. And it's arguably the most successful physics theory ever. It's given us the transistor, the computer revolution, cell phones, lasers, you name it. But for about 100 years now, physicists have also argued about this, what to really make of it. And the reason is the textbook version of this theory, the Copenhagen interpretation as it's called, is kind of incomplete, because the Schrödinger equation in quantum mechanics says that little particles can be in multiple places at once. And I'm, of course, made of particles, right? So that means I can be in several places at once. But you never see that, your friend being in several places at once, at least sober. So this Copenhagen stuff invented this extra thing called the collapse of the wave function, which was supposed to randomly get rid of all the different versions of you except one and bring back order and make it the way we see it. But in the 1950s, a young grad student named Hugh Everett came up with this really radical idea that forget about all that Copenhagen collapse stuff and say that this equation always holds, no exceptions at all. Then you can really end up in two places at once. For example, if you're making a snap decision about where to hit your shot in a tennis game, whether to do a lob or a passing shot, you know, that might come down to just what one atom is doing in your brain that then escalates through your neural network processing. And suddenly the whole tennis ball is in two places at once, and then either you won the Wimbledon final or you didn't, and now you're in two different places, and things totally branch out into basically two parallel realities.
But there's no way that I mean, I would never have any contact with this other universe. I mean, it's just off in some other dimension, and there's, you know, physically it would be impossible for me to visit that other universe.
Well, people for a long time dismissed this, saying even if it's true, it doesn't have any practical relevance. But the reason people are getting more interested in it now is because you can actually use this weirdness, if it's actually true, to calculate certain things faster by building so-called quantum computers. So there are certain math problems which would take longer than the age of the universe to solve on a normal machine, which one of these quantum computers might be able to do in under a minute.
But the quantum computer still cannot get into the other parallel universe, can it?
Well, the way it actually works, one way you can think about it is that it's running the ultimate sort of parallel processing by tapping into the computational power of these parallel universes and then ultimately putting it all together for you and telling you, here is the answer. So we don't know yet whether they're going to work or not. If we do build these machines, and there's millions and millions of dollars right now invested in this endeavor, and if they work, then I think actually a lot of physicists are going to start taking much more seriously that these parallel universes exist.
Now, there are a lot of people, including a lot of physicists, who think all of this is a crackpot idea. I mean, you are talking about things that are so theoretical, so removed from the empirical world of scientific experiment, of testability, that you're taking physics off into what the science writer Jim Baggett calls fairy tale physics.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that criticism?
It's a very, very important question to bring up. You know, is this really science or is it just science fiction or pure speculation? So the lines are blurred. And why is that? Well, basically because the difference between science and science fiction is whether something is testable or not, right? But parallel universes are not a theory. They're a prediction of certain theories. And if we don't like those parallel universes, well, then we have to come up with a theory that's better than inflation, that doesn't have space going beyond where we can see, but which can still explain successfully all the other things inflation had.
But the problem with multiple universes is you're talking about a different universe that we can never go to. I mean, almost by definition, we can't. I mean, maybe there's some theory.
Right.
I mean, it would seem that that is not testable then.
You're quite right. We can never go test the parallel universe's existence by going there and looking at them by definition. That's not testable. But the theory that predicted them is testable. So what I'm saying is if you buy the theory, you need to buy the prediction. Similarly, black holes, what happens inside them, we consider science because Einstein's theory of gravity predicts what happens in black holes, right? Is that testable directly by flying into a black hole and then coming back and reporting on NPR what you found? No way. Black holes are like a one-way trip. If you enter the event horizon, sorry, you know, game over. But that doesn't mean that black holes are science fiction. So we can't opt out of predictions of a theory unless we also reject the theory itself.
Max Tegmark is a theoretical physicist at MIT. He talked with Steve about his new book, Our Mathematical Universe. These multiverse theories are kind of mind-blowing and controversial. But for a truly earth-shattering controversy in physics, let's go back 500 years. In 1514, the astronomer Nicholas Copernicus floated a revolutionary idea to a few friends that the sun, not the earth, is the center of our solar system. The idea was so radical, Copernicus refused even to publish it. Davis Sobel tells the story in A More Perfect Heaven. When the book first came out, she told Jim Fleming it's hard to appreciate how transformative this idea once was.
School children today know it. The rest of us know it only because we've been told. It's not at all obvious that the Earth is in motion. It certainly doesn't feel as though it's moving, does it?
No. No, and I guess that what you then move immediately onto is the realization that the whole world was different. The world into which Copernicus was born was in a lot of ways not at all like the world in which we live, was it?
Not at all. And he was involved in so many things. He was a cleric in the church, but then he was also a medical doctor, his bishop's personal physician, and because of the Knights of the Teutonic Order who lived all around the area of Poland where he grew up and then spent his adulthood, he was actually engaged in active warfare from time to time. And then there was great religious upheaval. It was during Copernicus's time that Martin Luther broke from the Catholic Church, not to mention Columbus's travels while Copernicus was a college student.
The whole world was changing, in other words. And in the midst of all of this, Copernicus is, of course, contemplating a change in the way people will think about the planet and on which they live. And we see that again as revolutionary. Did he see it as big a change as we do?
Yes, indeed. He knew it was a monumental change, and that was part of what gave him his anxiety. He knew it was philosophically difficult, that it seemed to go against common sense and people might ridicule him. And, of course, he feared a religious backlash.
What was different about Copernicus that caused him to see the world differently?
No one really knows that. But when he saw how putting the sun at the center would organize the planets in order of their speed, he knew he'd hit on something powerfully important. So he was alone and felt alone and was frightened of what would happen if he publicized his idea.
Well, this brings us back to Rheticus, who's at the center of your story, this young Lutheran man who braved a trip into Catholic territory where he was forbidden.
Yes. Their meeting was so important because it united these two people, one old, one young, the different religions, but they came together over that idea, and then it was that book that really did change the world.
But it must have been extraordinary because, well, we start with the fact that Rheticus came into a place where he knew he wasn't wanted, and then persuaded a man who had been afraid his whole life to publish this book to change his mind.
Convinced Copernicus to do what he'd avoided doing for a lifetime.
Yeah.
That must have been some conversation.
Now, of course, what he published is not the Copernican universe that we see today. It was an early version of it.
Well, we no longer think that the sun is the center of the universe, but only the center of the solar system.
It took the work of Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler to expand upon the Copernican theory?
Indeed. Tycho brought many more and better observations to bear, yet he couldn't accept Copernicus's theory. And one of the reasons he couldn't accept it, he couldn't accept the expanded cosmos. For Copernicus's idea to be correct, the stars had to be much farther away than people had thought. And Tycho couldn't believe that either. And so he clung to the idea of the Earth at the center. He put all the other planets in orbit around the sun and had that whole whirligig moving around the Earth.
What was the reaction of the world at large when this book was published?
His book came into print with an anonymous preface that he didn't know about, that told people not to take the idea too seriously, that it was just another way of thinking about doing the calculations. So he was protected from any outright criticism for a while. It was only when Galileo's discoveries began to provide a body of evidence for what Copernicus had suggested, and when Galileo began speaking out in favor of Copernicus, it was at that point that the church took issue with Copernicus.
Not during his lifetime, basically, but
no,
later.
He died as soon as the book was finished. So he never knew what the response to it was. But the big question in the way people look at this issue is whether humanity was demoted from a place of central importance. I think at the time, the center was not considered an exalted place. It was merely different, profoundly different from everything else. So all the heavenly bodies were thought to be made of a perfect, everlasting, unchanging substance, whereas things on the earth were made of earth and water and air and fire. And there was lots of change, and there was death and decay. So it wasn't the best place in the universe. That was reserved for the heavenly bodies and all the way out beyond the stars, God and the angels. And the bigger problem for Copernicus was taking the Earth and making it a wandering star like the other planets, making this pit of decay a celestial body, and taking the sun out of the heavens and putting it at the center. This was a philosophical conflict of great depth.
Deva Sobel talked with Jim Fleming about her book, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. Coming up, how to visit Mars without leaving Earth. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about what's out there at the edge of the cosmos, and no one makes the case for the wonder of astrophysics better than Neil deGrasse Tyson. He runs the country's most famous planetarium. He's a frequent guest on late-night TV, and Tyson has a story of his own first experience of the wonder of the cosmos. He was 9 years old on his first visit to the Hayden Planetarium, the place he now runs.
There's this odd room. It's round with a hemispherical ceiling and this creature-looking piece of hardware in the middle of the room, and the light's dim. You don't know what that thing is going to do. Is it going to come out and attack you? But then the splendorous night sky appears above your head. I thought it was a hoax at first. I was born in the Bronx. I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. And here were thousands. I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky. And I was struck. Star-struck, really. And I would say that my path to become an astrophysicist wasn't even my choice. I was called by the universe, and that was my first true encounter with what I would call wonder. Here's what I wonder, though. Suppose I grew up on a farm, and the actual night sky was there from birth, from my first wanderings out onto the porch. Would I ever have taken it for granted, such that a first visit to a planetarium wouldn't have been any different from what I saw from my backyard, and so it would have less impact on me? I always wonder about that. What we found, and what I found personally, but research also shows, that in order for an exhibit to make a completely indelible mark on your memory and on your emotions and on your mind, it's got to be bigger than you are. And that will greatly increase the chances that it'll be unforgettable. Think about it. You are transported into space. You're moving through space. It is bigger than you are. The good student in class is the one who obeys the teacher, who is not disruptive, who is quiet when they're told to be quiet, who is seated and not fidgeting when they're told to be seated and not fidgeting. That is like the opposite of curiosity and wonder. Curiosity and wonder is I have this energy gurgling within me. It's bubbling over. I've got to express it somehow. I think this sit down, shut up, learn and take an exam is incommensurate with cosmic discovery. What we don't appreciate as adults regarding kids is that they are persistently and perennially curious, and it's really forces of society that kind of squash that curiosity. They already have the wonder. My worry is, how do we get that sense of wonder back in the adults? The kids are not the problem here. It's, you know, for every adult that says, how can I get my kid interested in science? I said, the kid is already interested in science. It's you I got the problems with. The kids are already curious about the natural world, and left to themselves, they will explore it.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is director of the Hayden Planetarium. Joe Hartke did the sound design. Most of what we just heard is from NASA's own sound library, including the sped-up sound of the Big Bang itself. And speaking of wonder, what would it be like to set foot on Mars? There are places on this planet where you can actually get a good idea, and you don't need a spaceship to get there. Writer Craig Childs just wrote a great magazine piece about exploring Mars analogs. It's called How to Visit Another Planet Without Leaving Your Own. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Craig, I have no desire to visit Mars. It looks cold and bleak and forbidding, and you can't breathe the air, and there's nothing to drink. You, on the other hand, confessed in the pages of Orion magazine that you would like to hike on Mars. Why?
So I didn't convince you?
I'm afraid not.
Well, the desolate properties. I'm a desert traveler, and I like to travel in glacial landscapes, you know, places that are very exposed. But also the size of the landforms on Mars, just the enormity of Olympus Mons and the deep canyons. I just think, oh, that would be such a wild sensation to go out and actually just walk across that planet.
You know, that's fascinating. You're talking about Mars in a way that we've only been able to do fairly recently. Because if you think, I mean, going back since the 70s, NASA has been sending satellites and probes and then finally rovers to Mars. And the photographs have been getting better and better and also more and more specific so that you can now do what you just did, I guess, pick out mm-hmm. particular landscapes, particular places on Mars that you'd like to visit?
Well, they've become so clear that now we're looking at it saying, oh, well, this isn't some planet made of cheese. This is actually a planet that looks like ours in many ways, without the life, without the masses of open water. But it looks like the same principles you see here. You see rocks exposed with geologic layers, with bedding plains. You know, you see dunes. You see glaciers and moraines. The pictures we're getting make me want to walk there.
Are there particular photos you've seen that have just really wowed you? I mean, you've looked at places and said, okay, that goes on my bucket list?
Oh, yeah. You know, along the edge of the polar ice caps, where big pieces of ice have fallen off and are just scattered around, melting and just covered with the red dust. I want to see some of those big dust devils that are rolling across the landscape out there, some out on the big desert plains.
Okay, you're almost convincing me. Well, the point of your article, though, is that there are places on Earth that are kind of like Mars, Mars analogs, you call them, which happen to be a lot of the places that you've hiked, for example.
Well, what comes right to mind is the Atacama Desert in South America. It's a landscape that I find beautiful, that I don't think a lot of people would find that way, but it's a place where, in many parts of the desert, rain hasn't fallen for decades or even centuries or even for the entire history of gathering rain data. These places are just absolutely barren. But, you know, barren to me is really enticing because you can see the shapes of the earth. You can see the way that rocks are sticking up in the air and just brutalized by winds and turned into these sculptures. And it looks like Mars. It really does.
Is it all flat? Are there mountains?
No, there are mountains. There are these big flat areas called salars, these salt depressions that you just take days walking across them, and then it rises up into a 2,000-foot ridge made entirely of salt that's jagged and bizarrely eroded. It's like walking into a salt castle. Eventually rises up to mountains that are standing 19,000 feet.
Wow. You said it's all this salt, crystallized salt. That makes me think of a landscape that would be sharp, pointy.
Yes.
Hurtful.
It is. There are times I was backpacking across one of these salt regions and we just could not find any place to even sit down. And we were walking into the night for hours until we found a spot that we could crawl into to sleep. It just would tear you apart. And I guess that's not convincing you either, is it?
Well, I'm fascinated because I'm curious about what draws you to these places, to places that are, you know, really inhospitable.
I think it's the elemental quality. And don't get me wrong, I love forests and lakes, but it just, when you strip everything else away and look at the bare bones of things, that is a different experience.
You said there's not been any rain there for decades, so obviously that's kind of like Mars. When you're there? Does it feel like the moisture is just being sucked out of your body with every minute?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you're carrying your water on your back, and your skin is drying, and you're doing everything to keep the sun off of your skin. After a while, you just can't walk into the sun. It just, you feel like you're going to pop.
So how long were you hiking there?
Well, that was a trip that was only probably 9 days of carrying water.
You carried enough water for 9 days?
Yeah.
How much
heavy
water is that?
9 gallons.
Now, this is a place, the Atacama Desert, I think, that NASA used to test some of the Viking landers.
Right. Testing the biotic properties of being able to determine if there's life or not. That was their one of their target locations.
And so what did they find in the Atacama?
That there is no life. That if you would have landed a rover on the Earth and it landed there, it would report back that the Earth is a dead planet.
See, I had no idea there were even places like that on Earth, places that are dead.
Actually, if you drill down into the salt, you find microbes. And that's what we'd be missing on Mars, is that we haven't gone down under the surface, really.
So I'm curious, what does it feel like to be in a place that is really kind of not on a biological scale?
You feel like you got sneaked in, that you're not supposed to be there. And I guess in a way it would be like sneaking into a museum at night or something, where you're not allowed to be. And that's what it feels like on a grand scale of living creatures are not allowed to be here. And yet here you are walking across it. It feels like magic.
And we haven't talked about beauty. We've talked about the ruggedness and the harshness, but do these places also seem, does the Atacama seem beautiful to you?
Oh, yeah. I can imagine dull landscapes, but these are not. The salt formations are elegant. You have this huge sky sitting on top of these rough formations. It is like walking through a sculpture gallery. It is really quite beautiful on many scales.
Because I was thinking, there's such a long tradition, at least in the West, of admiring landscapes that are teeming with life in some way. You know, we love forests and lush meadows and rivers and oceans and snow-capped mountains. And I was wondering whether to appreciate this kind of Martian-style landscape, maybe we'd need to cultivate a different kind of aesthetic.
Yeah, I think that we've got to look at the harshness as beauty. And I don't think everybody can do that. I think to live on Mars, to spend any time there, you'd need to understand landscapes differently. You'd have to take them into yourself differently and really consider a different kind of beauty.
Another place you've been that you consider a Mars analog is an ice sheet in Greenland. So a very cold location. What's Mars like about it?
It's even more sparse.
Nothing but white and sky?
Yeah, because you don't have terrain. You have crevasses, but you don't see them until you're right on them. You're just looking across a white horizon. When you're standing out in it and you're away from your camp, the Earth is two things. It's sky and snow, and that's it.
In your article, you said that you kind of made a bet with the ice scientists there that they said you couldn't walk a straight line out there, that nobody can.
Yeah.
How come?
I don't know. Our brains are just not. We've never lived in a place that doesn't have landmarks, that doesn't have something to cue off of. And I tried and tried. At one point, I was walking out away from camp and just looking at the ground. I didn't have any references. My hood was covering the horizon. And I thought I was walking in a straight line. And after 15 minutes, I looked up and there was camp straight ahead of me. I had turned completely around.
You wrote something that was sort of amazing to me. You said the water there, and I guess you melt the snow or the ice to drink, it's so pure you can't drink it straight?
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't have anything in it, no minerals, no salt. So it actually starts pulling minerals and salts out of your stomach lining, and you get a stomach ache. So you have to add tea or lemonade or something to it.
I read that and I thought that was the moment where I got this visceral sense of how profoundly inhospitable to human life that kind of landscape is.
Yeah, that is not a place where we can live. When I looked at our time there, and it was a small camp, a 7-person research station, I just thought the only way you can live out here is to have a whole civilization behind you, you know, infrastructure of of transport planes and all kinds of stuff that allow you to survive out here. Because otherwise, I mean, you leave your little tent in the night and you stand out there in 60-mile-an-hour wind, and you realize that you would last, you know, a minute or two if you were just thrown into this place, that you feel the fact that you are dying when you step outside and you're not properly protected. And to be there for days, weeks is it's like being on Mars, I suppose.
Craig Childs lives in western Colorado. His essay, Walking on Mars, appeared in Orion magazine. Coming up, physicist Sean Carroll says some of the craziest theories about the universe are almost certainly true. The question is, are we brave enough to believe them? I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Steven Weinberg. I'm a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, and the author of several books. The latest is To Explain the World, The Discovery of Modern Science. In this book, I confront a number of the issues that have bothered scientists and students of the history of science for centuries. One of the most perplexing is the role of beauty in science. Paul Dirac, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, said that physicists shouldn't worry about the meaning of their equations. The important thing to think about was the beauty of the equations. Certainly going too far, and very bad advice for graduate students. But it's still true that down through the centuries, scientists have sometimes been powerfully assisted by an aesthetic sense. For example, Copernicus threw out the whole apparatus of epicycles of Ptolemy, in which the planets go around in circles and the centers of the circles go around the Earth and the Sun goes around the Earth. He threw that all out, not on grounds of better observations, because in fact he didn't make better observations. He used the data provided by Ptolemy, but on the grounds of the beauty of the theory. So his aesthetic sense really began the scientific revolution. Why should that be? Why should a sense of beauty be of practical assistance in the work of science, even though sometimes it can be misleading? I think it's because the world acts on us like an unplanned, undesigned, but still effective teaching machine, that by interacting with nature and trying again and again to explain the world, we've gradually learned what kind of explanations work and what don't work. And just as a designer of sailboats may get a sense that a certain kind of beauty in the hull produces a boat that sails well, we've learned that a certain kind of beauty in our theories makes the theory more likely to be true. But unlike the early Greeks, we know that we have to test these theories experimentally and that nature always has the last word.
Steven Weinberg is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and the author of the book To Explain the World. And now for some really big questions. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at Caltech, and he's the kind of guy who likes to speculate about the meaning of it all. He's just come out with a book with a suitably sweeping title, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. That's intellectual catnip for Steve Paulson, so of course he sat down to talk with Sean.
Sean, you've coined a phrase that describes your philosophical outlook on the world, what you call poetic naturalism. What is that?
Well, naturalism is an old idea. It's just the idea that there's only one world, the natural world, the world that we perceive by doing science experiments and so forth, the world that obeys the laws of nature. Poetic is added on because there's different forms of naturalism. Naturalists disagree with each other, which is a good, healthy thing. There are very austere, bare-bones naturalists who really think that the only thing that truly exists is the fundamental description of reality, you know, the electrons and protons and neutrons, or the quantum wave function of the universe. That means you don't believe that chairs and tables are real. They're just illusions because they're made out of all these things. And I think that goes too far, personally. And then on the other hand, there's the naturalists that aren't quite willing to go all the way to the physical world. They want to say that there's only the natural world, but they want to add something to it, either mental properties that the physical world can have over and above its physical properties to help explain consciousness, or perhaps objective moral principles that tell us right from wrong in addition to what the universe actually does. So poetic naturalism is in between because I don't believe there's anything extra other than the physical world, but there are many ways of talking about the physical world. That's where the poetry of it all comes in.
Right. So there's kind of a religious framework for talking about some of these things as well. And I mean, that's atheism. And clearly you are in the atheist camp, but my sense is that you find that label somewhat limiting.
It's not that I find it limiting. You know, I'm very happy to accept it. It's just that it's less informative. There are naturalists who are not atheists. You could not believe in God, but you could believe in something spiritual over and above the natural world. Or you could believe in the existence of immaterial souls, right, like René Descartes did. He was also religious, but there's room in between being a naturalist and being a conventional theist.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was surprised to read that you grew up in an Episcopal church, and you liked it. In fact, you say you loved the mysteries and the doctrine.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, if that's what the universe had turned out to be like, I would have been fascinated to study those things. My favorite book of the Bible was the book of Revelation because it was just the most awesome and, you know, mind-blowing. It was like Game of Thrones 2,000 years ago, really. But I eventually decided that probably was not the most correct description of the world. And I don't think it's actually surprising. I think that many contemporary people who are not very religious grew up in religious households one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider the most remarkable insights from the world of physics in recent decades?
Recent decades?
Yeah.
We're still kind of cleaning up the mess made by the early 20th century in physics with relativity and quantum mechanics and so forth.
I'm interested in how you describe that as the mess.
Oh, God, it's a terrible mess. It's embarrassment. It's terrible.
Because there are so many mysteries that still haven't been resolved?
Well, mysteries are good. Mysteries are fine. Mysteries are what drive science. But that's not the embarrassment. The embarrassment, the mess, to me, is the fact that quantum mechanics is our most successful theory of nature. It is clearly true in some way, in some version, in some sense. And yet we don't know what it is. We've been using it for, 90 years now. And if you said, okay, what does quantum mechanics say? 30 different physicists are going to give 25 different answers.
What do you mean you don't know what it is?
We don't know what it is. Like if you have general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, okay? Everyone knows what that is. It says that there's something called space-time. Space-time is four-dimensional. It has a certain way of measuring distances in time and space. And there's an equation called Einstein's equation that tells you how space-time curves. Everything is perfectly well-defined, unambiguous. That's what you want in science. In quantum mechanics, you say, okay, well, there's stuff called wave functions. And when you observe a wave function, it collapses. But then instantly, people start disagreeing, like, does it really collapse? What does it count as an observation? Does the collapse represent our knowledge, or is that a physical truth? Is there some extra variable that is making it collapse? Is it deterministic? We don't know any of these things. And that's an embarrassment and a mess to me.
But has progress been made on these fronts?
Yes, absolutely. You know, in the 20s and 30s, right after you invented quantum mechanics, people worried about this stuff a lot. Schrodinger and Heisenberg and Bohr and Einstein would argue back and forth in this old school, heavily philosophical European way of thinking about things. And then the 40s and 50s came along, and we needed to make bombs, and we needed to smash particles together and watch what was happening. And it became much more practical, and forget about the philosophy, let's just do the calculations. And it's only been, I think, in the last couple of decades, a little bit of attention has been refocused on these foundational issues.
And yet, I mean, going back to that philosophical orientation of those early 20th century physicists, it would seem that those big questions are still with us. I mean, what is the fundamental, ultimate nature of reality? And what about questions about determinism, for instance? We never know if a particle, where it is at any particular moment. I mean, aren't those questions sort of still out there?
Well, some questions are still out there. I mean, the fact that we don't know the fundamental nature of reality yet should not be taken as a sign that physicists have somehow failed over the past few decades. We haven't known that for a very long time. When Democritus came up with the idea of atoms, it took over 2,000 years to get good evidence for it. The question of determinism, for example, we thought we had solved. If you were Isaac Newton, or even better, if you were Pierre-Simon Laplace, who came after Newton and really understood the implications of Newtonian mechanics for questions of determinism, you thought that the universe was clockwork. You thought that there absolutely was determinism. It's right there in the equations. Our confidence in that result was undermined by the appearance of quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics, all you can do when you have an experimental setup and you want to predict what will happen is predict the probability that you will see something rather than the certainty of it. So now we're back to not knowing whether the universe is fundamentally deterministic. There are deterministic versions of quantum mechanics, like the many worlds interpretation.
You subscribe to, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think that the universe is most likely deterministic. But there are other models that are also on the table and plausible, which are fundamentally non-deterministic. So I think that that question has now again been reopened.
Let me just pursue this for a moment, this many worlds interpretation of the multiverse. I mean, this idea that, it's not just this one universe in our observable universe. It's an infinite number, right?
Well, it's at least a very big number.
Yes. It would seem that there's no empirical evidence for this. I mean, yes, the mathematical models might suggest this. Are we sort of moving outside the realm of science to embrace a model like that?
No, there's lots of empirical evidence for it. All the evidence for quantum mechanics is empirical evidence for it. It's really more a matter of courage than anything else. If you believe in quantum mechanics at all, for example, you believe that an individual particle like an electron can be in a superposition of two possible states. Let's say it's a rotating, spinning, clockwise or counterclockwise. The question is, do you think a person can be in a superposition of having seen an electron spin clockwise or having seen an electron spin counterclockwise? And now if you just take at face value the equations of quantum mechanics as written down by Heisenberg and Schrodinger, etc., the answer should obviously be yes. I mean, there's no difference between an electron and a person, except a person is bigger. So if you don't undergo some failure of nerve, you would say, sure, these people can be in superpositions also. And for that matter, the whole universe can be in a superposition.
But in this version, there are many, many versions of you, Sean Carroll, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you really think that. I mean, you think some decisions you made some years ago, that created a whole different Sean Carroll, and there are thousands, millions of Sean Carrolls out there.
Do I detect that you have lacked the courage to believe in the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics? Is that you've lost your nerve?
I think I have lost my nerve, yeah.
I mean, nothing that you're saying now is a science argument, right?
No,
it's just
you're right.
Vaguely uncomfortable.
Yes. Okay, so this is
not good. That's not really enough. I have a theory that fits the data and is well-defined and is beautifully simple and can be applied to any kind of physical system. And you say, yeah, but there's a lot of me's out there. It kind of is creepy.
But isn't this a theory that you will never be able to prove?
Well, you never prove any theory in science. That's not what science does.
Okay. It seems that science still really does not have an explanation for two fundamental questions about reality. One is, how the universe got started. In other words, you know, was there anything before the Big Bang? I mean, sort of what we've just been talking about. And the other is the relationship between mind and brain. I mean, how the immaterial stuff of our minds, our thoughts and our feelings somehow emerges from our brains. It's still a huge mystery. Would you say those are two basically unanswered questions still?
Yeah, I think that of all the unanswered questions we have, those are the two that are the least surprising that they're unanswered. I mean, you've literally picked the thing that is as far away as it is possible to get from us now, the beginning of the universe, and the single most complicated thing that we know about in the universe, human consciousness. So the fact that we don't understand them, again, the least surprising thing in the world.
Do you think we'll ever understand those questions?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Consciousness.
No problem.
Wait, no problem for consciousness.
Yeah. No problem for the universe, for consciousness, for the origin of life. I mean, that's, you know, look, it's easy to forget how far we've come. Think about what we knew about the universe 100 years ago. We didn't know it was expanding. We didn't know there were other galaxies. We knew essentially nothing accurate about the universe on large scales. And within the course of 100 years, we put together this beautifully accurate picture that takes us from 1 second after the Big Bang to 13.8 billion years after the Big Bang that fits the data all along the way. To think that 100 years from now, we will not make similarly mind-blowing amounts of progress seems to be ahistorical to me.
Hmm. Now, you said that your book is essentially an exploration of ontology, of, you know, of what this is all about, in a sense. What is it that we still need to understand? If there was sort of some fundamental message, if that's the right word, that you wanted to get across with your book, what would it be?
Maybe those are two separate questions. I think there's so many things that we still need to understand. We don't understand, as you've already said, the origin of the universe. We don't understand the origin of life. We don't understand the nature of consciousness. We don't have a consensus among each other on how to be nice to each other or how to live meaningful lives. The messages of my book are, number one, that there is one universe, the natural world, that obeys the laws of nature. And number two, that's okay, that it is not any cause for Nietzschean, Kierkegaardian deep anxiety about the nature of reality. It is a challenging view of the world because it sort of removes some of the crutches that we could lean on to give our lives meaning and purpose if we thought there was extra stuff out there. But it's also liberating in the sense that what the world is, what our lives are up to us to make something of. They're not given instructions. It's truly a creative universe full of opportunity. So I think it's actually kind of a happy message at the end of the day.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Caltech physicist Sean Carroll talking with Steve Paulson. Sean's new book is called The Big Picture. And that's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher, or check out our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Paulson put this hour together with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and John Merfeld. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.